You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. All right, today's show, Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize winning restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. Jonathan's been at it for a long time. He was the restaurant critic for LA Weekly. He came to Gourmet with Ruth Reichel kind of in around 1999 or so, went back to the Weekly, won his Pulitzer in 2007, and then he joined the staff of the LA Times in 2012. He's got a lot to say, an incredibly knowledgeable guy, a curious guy, loves his food, loves to write. So this is him and me talking, and we talk for a while because he's got a lot to say. So let's listen in. I've got a lot of questions for you.
I'm glad.
I got lots. We'll start off with your film, City of Gold. You had a film made about you.
That doesn't happen with restaurant critics very often.
I'm pretty sure it's the first.
I've never seen one, so maybe so.
All right, it's coming out by IFC. It's a documentary, a very sort of illuminating, revealing, but fun movie. And I guess the first question is, what made you decide to say yes?
I'm asked all the time to do the same sort of stuff we all are, right? The reality show things.
And you're always like, oh, God, I don't know.
You know, I'm sure it's perfectly fun to, you know, sit in for 2 days with the cast of Cupcake Wars. But it never seemed like something I needed to do. And Laura Gabbert, the director, won a dinner with me or bid for a dinner with me at a charity auction for a school.
Oh, wow.
And we had dinner and she proposed this and I said no.
So she bid on the dinner with this ulterior motive of trying to get you to do a film.
I believe she did.
Clever. So she was giving you the hard sell, and what convinced you, like, oh, yeah, this could work?
Well, I said no. We had coffee a few times afterwards, and my son ended up at the school that her kids went to. When you see somebody in the pickup line every day,
yeah,
then suddenly it becomes something that you have to deal with. And, you know, I liked her a lot. I thought that her movie Sunset Story was just beautiful. And with the internet, the idea of anonymity was a thing of the past anyway.
Well, that's an interesting, and it's a topic in the film itself is, you know, back in the day, not very long back in the day, restaurant critics were anonymous, period. Like, that was a given. You sort of addressed this fact. You sort of came out, so to speak. So all of a sudden, but you're now walking into a restaurant with a film crew. And what did that feel like?
Well, she always wanted to film the idea of reviewing a restaurant for the first visit. But I banned that. I mean, there's no way that you can review a restaurant while you have a film crew with you.
Yeah.
So the restaurants that we went to were ones that I had reviewed and I was more or less a regular at, and it was okay to have a crew there. It wasn't going to affect anything.
Well, let's talk about anonymity, and you've spoken about this before, and you speak about it in the movie. You know, in this day and age, there's the argument that it's kind of impossible to be anonymous. Your photo's out there. People, if they want to find out who you are, if restaurant owners want to know who they are, they will know. But, you know, for the more sort of high-profile restaurants, how much of when you walk in the door, they know you're there, how much does that color your experience, do you think?
I think there are maybe 15 restaurants in the country that can make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was the critic at Gourmet here, I was at Le Bernardin. I was in a very bad seat, having the only mediocre meal I've ever had there. You know, Eric Repair walks in, sees me at this table by the bathroom, does like almost a spit take. You hear like yelling in French outside in the lobby. And suddenly, the next two courses were the best things I've ever had in my life. He can make a difference. Danielle is famously a person that or a restaurant that produces for its regulars more than it does for, you know, people who just come in for their anniversary dinner. That's a problem in maybe the extreme top tier of restaurants.
Yeah.
I mean, but they know who the critics are anyway.
Exactly. I mean, I always feel with the anonymity thing, it's like, all right, for the most part, the average restaurant or even the good restaurants, you know, they're not going to be able to change the decor, the lighting, the wait staff, or the menu. I do think perhaps you'll get better service if they recognize you than you might get otherwise, but they're not going to – I don't think the food typically is not going to change. You know, the dishes are the dishes.
And it's not necessarily better service. It's more nervous service. I mean, you see the hand shaking when they're pouring the wine.
And you're just like, let me get that for you.
Or people will come to your table every 45 seconds to ask you how things are doing.
All right. So, yeah. So, okay. We'll agree that it can only affect it to an extent. But what about and I had this experience here somewhat at Bon Appetit, although we do not critique restaurants at Bon App. But when you get to know a chef, does that then affect your ability to write about him or her objectively? There's a scene in the movie where you're at Trois Mecs and Ludo Lefebvre is behind the counter and he's like, oh, shit, Jonathan Gold's here. Do you know Ludo, for instance? Do you try to meet the chefs but not get into a relationship with them? Or how do you handle that?
Well, there has to be a firewall. Mm-hmm. There is one chef in Los Angeles with whom I have a bit of an exception. My wife wrote a book with her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's been a family friend for a while. And her restaurants are harder to review. But I'm not super kind to them. I'm as hard on them as I am on anybody else's places. And you have to be able to lose friends.
Yeah. I mean, do you think you can be hard and fair at the same time, that you hope they understand? You're not necessarily being mean-spirited, but you can be critical without being mean?
I think I can. Oftentimes there's a really, you know, tricky line anyway, right? There'll be a restaurant whose ambition you greatly admire, who's doing things in the right direction, yet this are not being done well, and they need to think about this, and the front of the house doesn't work, and you do a review that won't necessarily stop people from going there, but it will send a signal that these parts are not working out.
There was recently, this last month, almost for last month and a half, sort of seismic reverberations in the food world when Pete Wells of the New York Times gave a not so kind review of Per Se. And what did you think of that review? And did you, you know, do you read those reviews?
Yeah, I read him. It's tough. That must have been a really tough one to do. And some of it, like the part of sending his friend in to get bad service, is gimmicky a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you should be able to infer everything that's going on from your own experience. Mm-hmm. But Thomas Keller's restaurants are a very particular kind of place. They're doing a certain thing. And if that's not your aesthetic, you don't like it. I mean, what he does is, you know, sort of extreme technical perfection. And if it's at the point where you're losing that, you have to deal with the sort of arcane ritual of the meal, the trillion courses, the, million upsells. And you're not getting that perfection that is presumably what you came in for, what he does, then that needs to be called out.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there, as a critic, obviously it's personal. But on the same token, you have to understand that, yeah, there are certain restaurants that maybe aren't your type of restaurants. But does that necessarily mean they're not a good restaurant? And how do you balance that with who the reader is compared to who you are?
I try to be fair. I know that not every restaurant is my kind of restaurant. And I know that every restaurant that is my kind of restaurant may not necessarily be what all the readers are looking for.
Well, I mean, I think that's what's fascinating about your writing. I generally read your review each week. And I often got asked the question when I was at Time Out in New York years ago. And one of the questions I was often asked was, well, what makes you qualified to write about restaurants? And you can answer that a lot of ways, but I think the bigger question is, or answer is, are you enjoyable to read? Do people want to read you? It's not necessarily how knowledgeable you are about food, but can you write about it in a way that's entertaining? And I'd be curious your thoughts on writing style versus food authority.
I think a lot of the times people assume a food authority they don't necessarily have. I mean, it's one of the things with journalism, right? I mean, you get an assignment, you fly off to Italy, you spend 2 weeks with water buffaloes, and suddenly you are the expert on mozzarella, right? Even if you've never had anything that didn't come from a deli before then, that you can always change what you're doing. But I can't pretend that I know this stuff. The process of coming to the knowledge, of going to a place and then figuring out what it means and coming to some sort of coherent conclusion about it, saying something about the culture, but it's the nature of the profession to come across as the expert. And I always think the most interesting part is the journey to becoming an expert.
I was curious about when you write about the sort of the new places as opposed to the, you know, the small strip mall discovery. And I was thinking to myself, like, what is the most L.A. of L.A. restaurants in the last, like, 20 years or so? And I was like, well, it's got to be Spago, right? At least as an East Coast guy's impression. So I was like, has Jonathan reviewed Spago? So I looked it up. And, of course, you have. And December 22nd, 2012, that's when you joined the Times in 2012, correct?
Right.
And if I could just read this, and I think this gives a good sort of impression of your write-in for those who don't read Jonathan Gold. All right, here we go. The first responsibility of any great restaurant is to keep you in the bubble, the soft-serve cocoon of illusion where you forget the world exists for anything but your pleasure. And the newly redesigned Spago, from the moment you toss your keys to the valet to the moment you stagger back out again, gives good bubble. That's a hell of a lead. And then you go on. The thick prime rib steak sings with the flavors of blood, age, and char. There's important art on the walls, including a photograph of a shattered cell phone the size of Pau Gasol and a painting you could swear you saw it at an Ed Rochet retrospective. And while the music may tend toward the sort of 80s rock your meathead younger brother may have stashed on his iPod, at least you are not picking at your Hearts of Palm salad to the beat of hotel lobby electronica. A, I love that. B, it's fun. It reads like you had fun writing that, and that when you came up with the bubble line, you kind of smiled to yourself and like you're like, oh, that's a good line. Is that fair to say that when you write something good, you're like, you know, you wrote something nice?
About 2/3 of the time, yeah.
Yeah, and that's got to be enjoyable. You're like, oh, that yeah, I got it. I got it.
Yeah, I did like the bubble thing.
But I think what's interesting about you, so how old are you now, if I may ask?
Mid-50s.
Mid-50s, okay. And L.A. is a very young city, you could argue, or at least people want to be young forever in L.A. But it's interesting, I also find you a writer who remains constantly relevant. And in that second paragraph, you reference Pau Gasol, formerly of the Los Angeles Lakers. Ed Rochet, iconic LA artist, 80s rock on an iPod. You know, it's like you stay in the game. And that's impressive to weave those sort of cultural moments into a food review that's not just about food.
Well, food is part of the culture. And there's nothing duller than people who just write about what's on the plate as if it's like suspended in a vacuum.
Yeah.
In some sense, in a technical sense, I'm really interested whether, say, a steak was cooked, you know, 30 seconds too long. And I know when a sauce is, you know, over-reduced. But you don't have to write about that stuff.
No, they don't necessarily want to know about the Maillard reaction. So in the movie lot, you're driving around. All right, first of all, what's with the pickup truck? You're in L.A., a city where everyone is judged by their car, and you've got this green Ram pickup. Like,
right.
What's the backstory with that?
The backstory is in L.A., you are very much what you drive, right?
Yeah.
It's a part of it. And
like, you pull up to the valet, and they kind of give you that once over. Like, they judge you immediately.
Yeah, and I've got to say that, and this is the most superficial thing in the world, on a sculptural level, I think that truck is gorgeous. Wait, it was the most gorgeous vehicle on the market the year that I bought it.
Which was when? What year?
97. And I remember like a couple months after I brought it, like pulling into the parking lot of, you know, Cafe Fanny, which was they used to be like the breakfast place run by the people at Chez Panisse. And I was talking to Alice Waters in the parking lot, and she was absolutely appalled by my truck.
What is your wife, Lori Ochoa, who's an editor at the Los Angeles Times, what does Lori think about the truck?
I think she's grown to love the truck. but then I told Alice, like, you would not believe how many organic turnips I could fit in the bed of that thing.
When you drive around, do you listen to music?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Like, does it have a CD player or do you have to listen to the radio?
Yeah, it has a CD player. It tends to be, you know, screechy jazz. I've been in an Albert Eiler binge for a while, and I listen to a lot of opera and chamber music. There's something very funny about, like, you know, pulling up to a traffic light and like bumping Puccini.
You don't have like a flatbed of speakers in the back of just yeah. I have a question. All right, so when I'm driving around LA or the suburbs, and you go by these strip malls, and as the uninformed, just sort of visitor or food person, it's very hard to tell one strip mall restaurant from another. On the sort of the higher end of restaurants, you can kind of tell who has their game together by the decor, the lighting, the tchotchkes, and who knows what's cool and who doesn't. How do you get turned on to where the potential finds are? Is it just driving around? Is it talking to people? Is it on the internet? What's your sort of mode of research these days?
I mean, all of the above. I drive around a lot. Obviously, the hot new restaurants are on whatever circuit those are on. You know, sometimes I'll spot a sign that I haven't seen. I'll go in. I haven't done it as much lately, though it's always useful, is to sort of over a period of a couple of weeks hit every restaurant on a particular stretch of road. So, for example, a lot of my San Gabriel Valley fixation started when I did something like that for the LA Times in 1990. I ate at every restaurant on a street called Las Tunas as it went through San Gabriel. And it was everything from sort of unimproved 40s hamburger stands to just the sort of wildest profusion of restaurants from, you know, recent Asian immigrants, you know, Indonesian place that specialized in salads. There was a Vietnamese place that had the best spring rolls I'd ever had in my life, a place that I continue to go to. There were places doing handmade dumplings. There was a Taiwanese coffee place called The Other Taste.
And this was 1990 you wrote this piece.
Right. Whose specialty was—
And you still remember all this.
Yeah, a drink of like tea and coffee mixed.
Yeah.
There was the first of the good Malaysian restaurants in town. And if you were driving by, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
They're just ugly mini malls on an ugly strip of street in sort of a forgettable part of a suburb.
Is it frustrating that— I imagine it's challenging for you to return to your favorite restaurants, your favorite little spots, when you constantly have to be discovering the new ones.
I wish I could go to more of them again, but I still manage to get to, you know, Golden Deli, you know, once a month. Still manage to get to, you know, Bledsoe's in Compton for, you know, their smoked brisket once a month.
What's your routine in terms of checking out new places? Who do you bring with you? How often are you bringing friends, and how often are you going solo?
I almost always bring people along, though. As one gets older, one has fewer of the sort of friends who can spend 5 hours to going to noodle shops on a Wednesday afternoon. But when I'm doing the sort of the cultural restaurants or the folk restaurants, I will, and yes, I am using circumlocution to avoid saying the word ethnic.
Yeah.
that, you know, often I'll go by myself and I'll go to half a dozen places in a day and have a dish or two in one. And if something blows me away, then I know that's something I have to keep going to. I usually will bring, you know, a friend. My family comes with me a lot. It's the usual rotation.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Family. So you have a son, you have a wife, obviously. How do you balance work and family? And do you have any sort of set guidelines that you adhere to in terms of seeing them?
Weirdly enough, one of the reasons that I do things the way I do is so that I can spend sort of a maximal amount of time with my family. I mean, I love my kids. And my wife has always had, you know, big jobs, right? I mean, she was the number two at Gourmet for years. She was the editor-in-chief of the LA Weekly. She's in charge of all the arts and entertainment coverage at the LA Times now. And, you know, I'm just a happy-go-lucky restaurant writer, so...
Do you try to do more investigating and eating during the day as opposed to nighttime, or is it a balance?
Probably more investigating during the day.
All right. One thing that's addressed in the film, and this is I once assigned you a piece. I was at GQ years ago, and I wanted you to write a very short 200-word thing on – it was like a travel package. It was someplace in the hills of Tuscany, or maybe it was Umbria. And I remember emailing Lori and talking to her, mm-hmm. and she's like, listen, Jonathan will do it, but you have to know, like, it's not going to be in on time, and you're going to get it when you get it, and then just – roll with it. And we got it at the very much 11th mm-hmm. hour. Have you always sort of procrastinated? Has it gotten worse? Has it gotten better over the years? What is your current status?
How do I put this? I always get the pieces in. I mean, I've never not, but it's that... Yeah, I definitely have a perfectionist streak. And I know, you know, I've been on your side of the desk mm-hmm. enough times to know that it's incredibly aggravating. And there are – not that I'm allowed to write for Lucky Peach anymore. Yeah. For some reason, the Times thinks it's competition. But sometimes, like, Peter Meehan will give me too much slack.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, you can sail through a deadline? I didn't know that. I mean, God doesn't actually strike you dead at the other end. I have a good story about that little thing I did for you at GQ.
Oh, you actually remember?
Oh yeah, it was one of my favorite places anywhere. It's gone now, but it was about half hour north of Arezzo, or more to the point for the GQ readers, I guess, close to the Prada outlet.
Yeah,
just like the. You know, everybody's like perfect ideal of the, you know, Tuscan country restaurant, right? It's like, you know, an antipasto table that was, you know, half a soccer field long. And the pasta was like hand rolled peachy with, you know, things like wild boar or pigeon. And then, you know, this giant guy comes out in a blood-stained apron who's been grilling your 3-inch-thick Fiorentina steaks over a fireplace upstairs.
I remember that part of the piece.
And the Chianti's growing out and back, you know, past the tractors. And I went there with my daughter, who was very young at the time. I mean, maybe 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. And I had this habit then of like pouring, you know, 3 drops of wine into a glass and then topping it up with, you know, sparkling water so that she would think that she was drinking wine, but wouldn't actually be. And there was a table of Americans who were just staring at me as
damn
if I,
Americans.
As if I were the, you know, devil incarnate.
Like a slow drip of opium into her veins, yeah.
And then, of course, I noticed that they had like a folded copy of that GQ.
No way.
Carefully.
I'm glad someone read it.
I almost felt like going over there and
let him know what's what. How do you stay hungry? That's what I'm always curious about with a job like yours.
It's not always easy to. Mm-hmm. No, sometimes you absolutely don't want to go out to dinner that night. But there's always – I assume it happens with theater critics too, right? It's like every time you go into a restaurant – or every time you go into a theater, you're waiting for, you know, the curtain to lift and for the best experience of your life to unfold on stage, even if you're, you know, bored and tired.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with restaurants, I think. I mean, the one where it gets hard is a place that you know that you're already lukewarm on, mm-hmm. and because you're lukewarm, you have to go more times.
Yeah. Well, those have to be the toughest reviews to write, I imagine, are the mediocre ones. The good reviews you want to enthuse about, the bad ones you're happy to be critical about. I'm not happy, but you have something to say. But it's got those sort of middle ones, those can't be easy, can they?
No, they're not. And you know, my column comes out, you know, every week in the Times. And they're just places that you have to write about that are – they may not be bad, but they're just not exciting. But I've got to say, when I worked for Gourmet, when there was a restaurant that wasn't particularly exciting, but that was the only thing I had to write about that month,
yeah.
The idea of having to think about a mediocre menu for an entire month was just torture.
Yeah.
And you would think that I would have just, you know, written in the first week and gotten it over with, but again, I'm a perfectionist. I kept going back and hoping there was something else going on.
It's got to be better than this, right? No. What's your take on best of lists? Is that just part of the job? Do you enjoy doing them?
In a certain way, I think I'm probably one of the Pied Pipers of them.
Mm-hmm.
I started editing the Best of LA issue for the LA Weekly in 1985 or six,
wow.
Right, when I was a wee tot. I guess 89 or 90 when the LA Times Magazine started. They wanted Ruth Reichel, who was the LA Times critic at the time, to do something. And I came up with the idea of like a top 40 list, top 40 dishes list for her. She did that. At some point, I was the restaurant critic at LA Magazines. I started their, you know, best 10 new dishes.
Yeah, man.
When I was at Gourmet, I started the 50 best restaurants in the country list.
Yep.
Wow. At the LA Weekly, I did the 99 essential restaurants. And I must say, the essential thing is my fiddle. It is, I would like to state here for the record, that was my fiddle. That means you don't have to worry about absolute quality. It has to be the restaurants everybody's talking about. And now everybody in the freaking world has essential lists.
Yeah, you have to do one now. And it's like, obviously, if you ever spend any time on the internet, everything is a list.
Yeah.
Everything is 10 this or 10 that.
But the essential fiddle,
yeah.
Especially. And you know, since Lockhart Steele claims that he saw it in some paper in Prague, let me say he did not.
And Lockhart being from Eater, one of the founders of Eater.
And of course, I do the 101 best restaurants for the LA Times, which is one of the most successful things we do.
Yeah, I think that's I would highly recommend that to any of the listeners online. I think they do a great job, both obviously the recommendations, the write-ups, the technical aspects of it. I think it's hugely useful to anyone, yeah, either living in LA or visiting LA. I mean, you must meet people who essentially plan their entire eating calendar around what you've written. Like they want to cross off all 101 restaurants from that list.
You would not believe how many people will come up to me and with their list and this, I've gotten to 68. Or they'll be really mad because one of the places is closed. Oh. They want to know what they can go to instead.
I get a substitute. You're in New York right now. Where did you eat last night?
La Sirena.
Okay, the new Mario Batali restaurant.
Yeah, which was really good.
And why that one? Why did you decide I'm going to go check that out?
Well, he hasn't really had a new Italian restaurant here.
Been a while. I thought that. I'm like, when was the last place?
I think Del Posto may have been the last one.
Del Posto was, what, 10 years ago or something?
At least.
Yeah, so in New York City. He obviously has, in L.A., has
right.
Mozza and Pizzeria Mozza and then Gispacca next door. Yeah, I was trying to remember the last time. I have not been yet. I always like to kind of – do you have a policy on how long you like to give a restaurant before you visit? Because that restaurant opened a couple weeks ago.
Well, I'm in New York, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, so you might as well. But just in general.
But I tend not to go in the first few weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, and sometimes – this is weird to say. It feels like being Casper the Friendly Ghost, right? You go in there, say, hi, guys, and everybody goes,
shit.
And some restaurants that have, you know, a lot of moving parts. Like there's a place that I reviewed a couple of weeks ago called Odium. It had been open maybe 3 months, but it's the project of Timothy Hollingsworth, who is the chef de cuisine at French Laundry for a million years. That it was actually built from the ground up, which is almost unheard of these days. It was, you know, attached to the Broad Museum, which is this big new art museum in LA. And he's actually trying to define American cuisine in certain terms. There's a lot of balls in the air.
Yeah.
And in a certain sense, the review I do next year will probably say more than the one I did now. But going there in the first couple of weeks, as I mistakenly did, was a mistake.
Do you acknowledge that in the write up that, like, hey, this is early, like?
Well, I mean, if I get a weird meal to begin with, it's almost a gimme.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, I've been there. This wasn't working. Let's come back and see what you're really doing.
But that's also one of those restaurants. And I do think if you're the critic for the LA Times or the New York Times, et cetera, that, I mean, that's a restaurant that is getting a lot of buzz, but it's also projecting a lot of buzz on its own. Like, it's part of the conversation. And you can't not go. You do have to chime in probably earlier than later with a restaurant like that, yes?
Yeah, and there have been restaurants that I genuinely don't like that have become huge parts of the conversation. I just end up having to go. I mean, I'll review it a year and a half late. I don't do it that often, but it's not as if I don't do it. And there are other kind of restaurants, especially live fire restaurants, which are restaurants that are everything is cooking in a wood oven.
No, yeah, you get in a lot of that, yeah, especially in L.A.
I mean, when I was here, Peasant was fantastic.
And that was years ago that Frank opened that in Nolita. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember it had been sort of, an actress, model, whatever restaurant in its first 6 months. And I completely avoided it. And somebody at the magazine said, well, you should probably go here. I think chefs go here.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, right. And I went in there and there was nothing remotely resembling a chef. And there was people who were at last year's hot restaurant.
Yeah.
And then at the next table, you know, in comes, Ducasse with Bocuse and Jean-Louis Paladin. And it's like, okay, chefs might come here.
Chefs with all capital letters.
I don't think I've ever seen like a table like that.
That's hilarious. But it's interesting. Like, and that was late 90s, right?
Yeah.
But it's, you know, nowadays with that company Grillworks, which is putting in like those big sort of like rotisserie sort of grills and the hand cranked and the lower and wood fired. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, that's, they're sort of everywhere, all over the country now.
But anyway, when you're doing live fire and you have that stuff, it takes a long time to figure out how each different, you know, thing is going to work, how each, you know, oven is going to work, how the grills and the fires and the flues and the whatever to sort of find the sweet spot. And then when you're dealing with a certain kind of wood oven, it takes probably a year to cure.
Yeah.
So sometimes the idea of having to address those right away is not completely fair.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, someone like Francis Mallmann has spent a lifetime figuring that out. You got to give guys a few months at least. What about in terms of what's your latest take on, you know, Yelp, blogs, like the fact that there's 8 gazillion food reviewers out there these days compared to when you were at Gourmet or, you know, there was you and Ruth Reichel, basically, you know?
Yeah, there are so many people who call themselves food writers.
Do you check in? Are you a reader of them? Do they influence how you do your job?
I don't think they influence how I do my job. I mean, it's, you know, I don't make a habit of reading a lot of Yelp reviews. I do check in on food blogs every so often, but there's so many fewer of them than there used to be, and blogs have almost disappeared. It's all Instagram feeds now.
Yeah.
But I would be foolish if I didn't use them as data points.
Yeah. I'm curious in terms of digital or analog, do you have like a big bulletin board with pins stuck in it and like the places you got to go, like you're hunting some like serial killer, or do you have like a list on your laptop?
I have a list on my laptop.
Yeah, it's not that romantic.
It'd be nice if I did that. I mean, I have never met anybody who's done that.
Yeah.
I mean, even my pal, you know, Robert Seitzema, who is the one who you would figure would do that.
Very old school. Yeah.
Do you remember his he had the first food zine ever? It was called Down the Hatch.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember actually trying to subscribe to it, and it didn't have an address even. It had like a phone number that you'd call if you wanted to subscribe. And he picked up the phone, right? And I talked to him for a little bit. He said, no, I have to put the stamps on myself and I have to copy everyone personally. And you're in Los Angeles and you couldn't possibly have a use for this.
Well, Jonathan, thank you very much for stopping by to chat with us. You have your new film, City of Gold, coming up by IFC.
March 11th.
March 11th. It's in theaters, but you can also probably get it on the internet, I imagine.
It is in theaters only. We IFC signed a deal with Hulu, so I guess starting in the fall you'll be able to get it on Hulu. But
go see it on the big screen, City of Gold.
It looks like Los Angeles.
but wait, before we let you go, we have our lightning round.
Okay.
All right, so either or questions, got to answer them. We'll start off. Twitter or Instagram?
Twitter. Twitter's my thing. I love Twitter.
Yeah. I follow you. What's your handle again?
At the J Gold.
Yeah. I recommend it out there, everybody. Follow him. AJ Liebling or MFK Fisher?
Liebling.
Between Meals, one of my favorite books about his time in Paris.
Oh, it's an astonishing book.
Yeah.
The sort of New Yorker triumvirate of food writers, like, you know, him, Joseph Mitchell and Trillin.
Yeah.
Astonishing. I guess Joseph Wexberg also.
They can write. Ramen or pho? And do you say pho or do you say pho?
I say pho.
Yeah.
You have to say pho. And as long as we're doing this, it's not banh mi, it's bun mi.
But wait, there's that terrible I don't want to say it's a terrible restaurant, although it's a ridiculous name. On Sunset, right by the Chateau Marmont, there's that restaurant called, I think it's Beverly Hills 9021 Pho. Have you ever driven by that? Yes.
It's really bad.
It's bad. All right, good to know that.
And you know, there's always the legendary restaurant called Pho King.
All right, wait, you have to pick one, ramen or pho?
Yeah. Pho.
Okay. Why?
I like ramen, but ramen lends itself to a kind of otaku or you know, it's a specialty thing. People are nerds about ramen the way they are about Star Wars.
Yeah.
And the current iteration that is really, really popular in Los Angeles is the sort of balls out tonkatsu ramen, which might as well be liquid pork fat, except I think it's even fattier.
Yeah, you're done for the day after you eat that.
Yeah. And pho is just so light and delicious. Essentially, it's a salad in the form of a soup.
Oh, I like that one. I might steal that. Breakfast taco or taco at midnight?
Taco at midnight.
Related, food truck or food hall?
Food truck.
Why? Tell me what you love about food trucks, because New York is not really a food truck city like LA is.
Well, there was a point, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago that I thought that food trucks were the radiant future, because anybody can buy one. I mean, the price of entry is pretty low. You rent a truck, you spend a few thousand dollars on like a vinyl wraparound, and you have a small kitchen, and you don't have to pay rent, really. Yeah. You don't have to worry about being in the right neighborhood. You just do what you do. It turned out that 95% of food trucks, like 95% of everything else, is really mediocre.
Yeah.
But there's still that idea of adventure, of entry-level capitalism, that you're just going to find something wonderful.
Jiro dreams of sushi or Tampopo?
Tampopo. Tampopo is just the best noodle movie ever made, maybe the best food movie ever made.
I remember seeing that in college, and I remember walking out just so hungry. I was like, I have to go eat noodles right now. Nothing like it since.
Yeah, and it's not even the noodle, just the noodle part. Though the noodle part is great too. That scene of them like making that ketchup omelet.
Oh yeah, that's the best scene ever at the end. Yeah, just in the omelet. That's amazing. That crazy, very weirdly erotic scene where they're passing the egg yolk between their mouths. That's insane. Yeah, it's a very. If you haven't seen it, please go see it, guys. Mm-hmm. Reporter's notebook or iPhone?
Reporter's notebook.
Yeah. Dodgers or Lakers?
Wait, that's unfair.
You got to pick one. It's a lightning round.
Lakers. I am so wounded when the Lakers lose, and the last couple seasons has been unbearable agony.
You know what? Life balances has a way of balancing itself out. You guys had a pretty good run there for like the last, I don't know, 40 years. You guys have to, suck it up.
When I lived here, I really tried to be a Knicks fan, and it was during the Sprewell year, so it's like it was really.
Yeah, they went to the finals that year, yeah.
But nah, it's like no, I bleed purple and gold.
Apple Pan or In-N-Out?
Apple Pan.
Yeah. Explain Apple Pan to people who have not been there.
Apple Pan is a 1940s lunchroom surrounded by, you know, giant buildings and shopping malls. They resolutely refuse to sell out. You wait in line. There's a very sort of rigorous system for that everybody has internalized on getting the seat at the counter. And it's the perfect California lunchroom burger. The lunchroom burger being almost more a textural thing than it is a thing of pure meat. So, you know, you get the bun that's crisped on the grill, you have the crisp lettuce, you have the tomato that is unripe, but this is one of the places where its unripeness and lack of succulence is. There's, you know, the onions are a little bit crisp. Actually, now I'm thinking, is there a tomato on it? There might not be a tomato.
Well, they have the relish.
You could get one.
They have that relish, which I find a little too sweet personally. But
you bite through it, and there's all these different layers of crunch that come together. It's sort of one perfect bite.
Carnitas or barbacoa?
That's a really hard one.
Well, you can pick. You get one.
I get one.
You're having lunch today. Are you ordering carnitas or barbacoa?
I'm in New York City. I'm not ordering either of them. But there is something about like the really great barbacoa from Central Mexico, from like, you know, Texcoco, where it is a whole lamb, and they wrap it in mague leaves, and they bury it, and it comes out, and it's crisp, and the lamb sort of like collapses in on itself, and it's not as much as it is juicy, but it almost is juice. So they serve it with a thing of the drippings, you know, consommé. Yeah. That you can moisten it with if you need a little, and freshly, you know, hand padded tortillas and a cold michelada. Man, I just made myself hungry.
Fortunately, it's almost lunchtime. I have no idea what this next question even means, kind of, sort of. The 101 or the 405?
Oh, the 101.
Why? This is a very obvious LA question.
The 101, also known as the Hollywood Freeway, begins in East LA. It sort of disappears in sort of like a welter of different freeways. But there are so many great places to eat off the 101. It's just, it's a wonderful freeway.
You just said it's a wonderful freeway.
I like freeway driving. I know people hate it. And in the film City of Gold, there is a lot of time sitting in my truck on freeways. And some people see the film and it just reminds them of how horrible LA freeways are. But you just know, right? You're in Santa Monica at 4 p.m. You've got to get to Pasadena. You know it's going to take you an hour and a half. You have great tunes in your car. You know, there's nice view from the freeway of the mountains and the Hollywood Hills and the city around you. and you watch the light change and you listen to Ornette Coleman, and an hour and a half later, you are where you are. It's this, it's Los Angeles Zen. It's the sort of ecstasy of movement.
LATimes.com or Los Angeles Times Delivery.
I love the sound of the paper thumping in my driveway. I love picking it up. I love the smell of newsprint. I love, you know, that first great cup of coffee that you make in the morning while reading the physical newspaper and the progression through it. You know, I won't front. I start with the sports page.
Me too. All right, last question.
Okay,
butter or olive oil?
Okay. This one I refuse to choose because I have recently become addicted to the beurre de Barat from the French cheesemonger Rudolph Lemonnier. He's kind of the rock star cheese ager in France. And he has this line of butter from Normandy that has as much flavor in one tiny smidge as you would find in like an entire pound of Land O'Lakes. And it's just this astonishing substance. I actually talked to him once. I said, you know, it's actually almost low calorie because you just need a little of it. And he looked at me as if I was absolutely out of my mind. It's like, no, I spread it 3 centimeters thick. But man, that's good. But I cook with olive oil almost exclusively.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Gold. Jonathan, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Belle Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mitra Kaboli and additional help from Christina Che and Lily Sherman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us anything about this or any episode, please email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.